You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show and podcast about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. I'm absolutely buzzing about this month's show because it is almost entirely dedicated to The Coast is Queer, Brighton's landmark festival of LGBTQ plus literature. For full disclosure, I do work on the production team at The Coast is Queer, so of course I'm biased, but I'm also very well informed, and objectively, the lineup is impeccable. So The Coast is Queer returns to Brighton's Atterborough Centre for Creative Arts on the Sussex campus and runs from the 9th till the 12th of October 2025. Headline writers this year include Women's Prize for Fiction winner Yael van der Weldem, Juno Dawson and Monroe Bergdorf, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay, Travis Alabanza, Damien Barr and Joelle Taylor. The wonderful Topher Campbell will open the festival with a specially commissioned performance lecture, and we've got panel sessions with publishers, writers and literary agents helping to demystify the publishing industry. We have got so many brilliant panels and in conversations across this weekend. I really, really urge you to check out the lineup. Whether you're queer yourself, an ally, or simply a literature lover, there really is something here for everyone. We also have a brilliant workshop lineup, and if you are a writer or looking into getting published, I really, really recommend having a look at these. They sell out every year, so do have a look. We've also this year got a pop-up queer heritage hub at the University of Sussex Library in collaboration with Marlborough Productions, which opens up Brighton's queer pass to festival goers. Tickets are on sale now, so do have a look at thecoastisqueer.com and check out our Instagram page at BTM Book Club to get information about everything we have spoken about on today's show. So, on the show, we talk to the wonderful Aisha Hussain, founder of the Queer Girls Book Club, about the event she's running with debut novelist Christina Fontes to talk about her new book, Where You Go, I Will Go. It's an absolutely brilliant novel, and this will give you an opportunity to have a really intimate book club style event with a novelist. We are also going to be talking to literary agent Abby Fellows about the publishing and industry offering this year, as well as writer and historian Kit Hayam about their book Before We Were Trans, and they're going to be also talking about their panel on creating a shared queer history. We are also speaking to debut crime writer DG Cortino about their fantastic novel, The Light and Shade of Ellen Swithin. DG will be appearing on a brilliant panel called Not That Innocent with a host of other fabulous crime writers. Also on the show, Sarah from Writers HQ will join us to talk about their Writing as Resistance Festival, which runs online through September. We've got a jam-packed show today, and I know you're absolutely going to love it. I had such a blast recording it. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, subscribe to the podcast, and most importantly, get your tickets to The Coast is Queer. Anyone who is anyone is going to be there, and tickets are selling fast, and I'd really hate for you to miss out, so this is your warning. Enjoy the show. Lifelong bookworm Aisha Hussain is the founder of the Queer Girls Book Club, a London-based group that was born out of a passion to spotlight and celebrate queer literature. Whilst writing her dissertation for her English literature degree, Aisha discovered the works of Sappho, Amy Lowell, and Alison Bechdel. Nurtured through her coming out journey by this literary canon, one thing became clear. Queer literature was expansive, healing, and sharing it was a radical act of community building and love. When she isn't doing book club admin or her day job, Aisha can be found dragging a bag of books around and insisting she doesn't need an e-reader in her local indie bookshop or passionately supporting other queer community events around London. Aisha, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Can you tell me, please, about the founding of the Queer Girls Book Club?
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. So as most sort of formative events in my life happen to start, it came after a particularly extravagant breakup. And it was post-pandemic. You know, the world had sort of existed in this bizarre purgatory for 2 years. No one really knew what they were doing of. The entire arts industry had been so profoundly affected by everything. And, you know, I found myself single on the sort of precipice of this new chapter of my life. And I realized that over the course of my relationship, I really hadn't, you know, integrated into the queer community as much as I would have liked to. And I, for better or worse, have been, you know, given what that how hard can it be, Jean? I, you know, I joined a couple of book clubs. I didn't really mesh with them. And, you know, I sort of thought, well, how hard could it be to start my own? You know, I can't be the only person who is craving community after this bizarre 2 years. And so sort of the timeline from this could be something I could conceivably do to, you know, I'm doing it. It was very, very short. And, you know, one Saturday morning, I sort of had this moment of I'm doing it. I'm just going to do it. Entered this bizarre fugue state. And 3 hours later, I had, you know, an Instagram, a code of conduct. I'd reached out to venues and I just sort of really threw myself into it. And the rest is history. I thought truly that my friends would have to indulge me and that I would be running the first few meetings out of my apartment. So, I mean, imagine my surprise when 28 people showed up to the first meeting. And I realized that unknowingly I had stumbled onto this need that other people in London had just for community and to discuss queer literature. And here we are 2 years later. It's the best decision I've ever made.
Oh, it's so brilliant. I'm such a fan of yours and everything you do. So how often does the Queer Girls Book Club meet?
So we meet on the last Thursday of every month. So it's a monthly thing. I tend to find that that really allows people, A, enough time to read the book, but B, it's, you know, it gives people a little bit of breathing space. I never want it to be a high pressure or a stressful undertaking. And, you know, meeting once a month is wonderful. You really get to sort of follow people through their lives and through our regular members. You know, you really build the most wonderful friendships. And as I said, we have this really lovely core member of people who've been coming for a while, but it also allows a really wonderful turnaround of sort of newcomers and people who drop in occasionally as well. So yeah, once a month.
Absolutely brilliant. So before we talk about The Coast is Queer this year and your involvement in it, what are your top three must-read queer reads?
Oh my goodness. So I started scaling it back from about 400 last week and I've managed to get it down to three. So the first one, which I have been waxing lyrical about for months, is Hijab Butch Blues by Lamya H, a book that, you know, has received incredible critical acclaim. It's the most beautiful story about the author and their, you know, their devout Islamic faith, but how they reconcile that with their queerness and with their non-binary identity. And I think their use of stories and parables from the Quran to explain and to enhance their own understanding of their own queerness and their sense of self is such an innovative interpretation of the Holy Word. It's really, really beautiful. And it stayed with me for ages. Incredibly beautifully written and really very funny at times as well. A very stark investigation of the self and really moving. And the next book I'm going to talk about is Stone Butch Blues by Leslie Feinberg. This is a book that I think I have managed to crudely insert into every book club meeting one way or another since the group started. It's one of the first queer books I have ever read. And it is the first queer book that we read at the club's first meeting in June of 2023. I think it's a very stark reminder of the inheritance of queerness and of the queer identity and the fact that, you know, queerness now is something to be celebrated and something to be exalted. And it's a community that we can joyfully share, but that, you know, it is a legacy of pain. Queerness was uncomfortable and it was difficult and it was fought for, sometimes at a very brutal cost. And I think it does everybody well to remember exactly what it is that we are fighting to maintain, especially because modern politics seeks to, you know, potentially strip us of rights that have been fought for by such brave and persistent and intelligent people. So Stone Butch Blues is one I'd absolutely recommend. And the last one is Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield, friend of the Coast is Queer Festival, and someone whose writing I am absolutely awed by. It's a story that is so haunting and so human. I did not sleep for 3 days after finishing Our Wives Under the Sea. It is a story that encapsulates grief and loss and the small incremental ways in which it quietly ruins you. And I think it is, you know, it can be a very powerful allegory for loss in any shape, whether that is through divorce, through illness, through death, you know, whatever it is, it is such a stark reflection of how grief and how loss can strip you and the people closest to you sort of hope and of humanity. And at the same time, it is so beautifully written. It's a story about two people that love each other, and it's a, yeah, I was so moved by it. And, you know, I recommend it to everybody.
Brilliant recommendations. Thank you so much. I will make sure we pop these up in the podcast show notes and also over on our Instagram page. Right, let's talk about The Coast Is Queer. This year, you are running a workshop book club event, which we're really excited about, with Christina Fontes talking about her debut novel, Where You Go, I Will Go, on October the 10th. Can you tell us, please, a bit about this book and what we can expect from this event?
Absolutely. So it is an intergenerational story. It's a mother and daughter story, and it intermingles between two different eras of time. So we focus on Bijou, who is writing, or whose character is written in 2004, and Mira, whose character is based in the 80s. Without giving too much about the plot away, it is ultimately a story about choice. It's a story about empowerment. It is a story about living for yourself, or it's a story of living for the expectations of others and the cost of making a decision in either direction. In many ways, obviously, it is a story about queerness, but I think it grapples with, you know, ideas of sacrifice and intergenerational trauma and pain. And, you know, those are stories that are relatable to so many people outside of, you know, explorations of sexuality. It's based around the Congolese diaspora and just paints a really rich cultural picture of those relationships in that culture. It's an incredible story, and I so look forward to discussing it with the author.
There's nothing quite like sitting with the author in front of a load of people who have read this book. And actually, one thing that I will say is that anyone who buys a ticket to this event gets sent a free, beautiful hardback copy of this book. So you don't have to worry about purchasing it. That's sent to you. You've got plenty of time to read it and get your questions ready for Christina ahead of this event. So you are also chairing a queer crime panel called Not That Innocent, which is an iconic name, if I say so myself, on the 11th of October. How excited are you, firstly? And what are you desperate to find out from these brilliant panelists?
Oh my, I mean, excited is too insufficient a word. I'm basically levitating off my chair with excitement at the prospect of, you know, really getting into it with these authors about these stories. In terms of what I'm most looking forward to discussing, I think for me, the idea of crime and queerness have always been inextricable. It's this idea that queerness was always an indicator and sometimes a judgment of somebody's morality, in the same way that, you know, explorations of true crime have been these in-depth analyses into the morality of the people that commit them. And, you know, I've always been really fascinated about that interplay, and the idea of morality and identity, and sort of just thinking about the idea of crime through the lens of queerness and to what extent that really informed the author's journey. You know, do these stories happen to be about queer people that get pulled into the world of crime? Or is there something, you know, that inherently informs the way crime can be committed and explored by queerness? And I'm really looking forward to getting into that discussion.
It's a brilliant panel and features writers Jack Jordan, Leslie Thompson, DG Cortino and Piotr Sipic, who was on the show last month. We've also got DG Cortino coming on the show to talk about The Light and Shade of Ellen Swithin. So stick around to hear that. So, Aisha, I could sit and talk to you all day, but why should anyone listening, queer, ally, straight, come to The Coast Is Queer?
I think if you value good literature, it's an obvious choice. These are stories about such a wide range of topics. I think queer people have always been on the artistic forefronts of, you know, analysing the times that we live in. And literature always holds up a mirror to the society that it exists in. And so I think if you want well-written, considered, profound, well-researched literature, whether you are queer or not, I cannot think of a better place to, you know, rub shoulders with intellectual, creative people and really immerse yourself in the best that the literary sphere has to offer at the moment. I can't wait to be there. I've got a countdown on my phone.
Aisha, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you and also get involved in the Queer Girls Book Club?
Absolutely. So please do give us a follow on Instagram. That's at Queer Girls Book Club. You're also welcome to drop me an email on queergirlsbookclub@gmail.com if you don't use Instagram. And then from there, all of the information about our meetings and how to get involved is available. And I hope to welcome as many of you as possible to one of our meetings soon. And if not, I will see you at The Coast is Queer.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Abby Fellows, literary agent extraordinaire, who is currently working at David Headley, joins us to talk about her work as part of the Coast is Queer steering group and the publishing and industry event she's taking part in this year's festival. Abby, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a quick introduction to yourself?
Yes, with pleasure. So my name's Abby Fellows. I'm an agent at DHH Literary Agency, and I've worked in publishing for about 20 years. I started as a bookseller, and I've done lots of different things, rights and bit of marketing, editorial, all sorts. But I've been an agent again for the second time for the last 6 years, I think. Yeah, 6 years.
So for anyone listening who doesn't know what a literary agent is, what is it to be a literary agent, and what are the benefits of having one?
So really, we are managing authors' careers from the whole process of discovering writers to helping them develop their work and then sending it to publishers, helping them to find a home for their work with a publisher, and then making sure they get the best possible terms on their contract, through to then supporting the author through the whole process up to publication and beyond, and really being their main point of contact through their whole career, ideally. I think the benefits are just having that person who really understands the ins and outs of the business, can explain what your options are, can advocate for you, and can really help you just get the best out of your career.
And how do you get a literary agent?
There's various ways. So some people are kind of talent spotted, which might be through writing in journals, having their work, journalism work published, writing Substacks, being on social media, but also a lot of agents have what we call open submissions, where people can send us a pitch and a sample of their work. A lot of my clients came to my list that way. They just emailed me speculatively, and I really liked what I read, and I started working with them from that point.
Brilliant. So, Abby, you are on the steering group for the Coast is Queer Festival. What does this role mean to you, and what is the advantage of having a steering group for a festival?
I really love it. It's one of my most favourite things I do. So I joined New Writing South as the trustee, and part of the reason I was so excited to join was that the organisation is behind Coast is Queer, which I'd admired for a really long time. It's really important for me that we have this space for LGBTQ writers, and being able to bring what I know about the publishing landscape to that, to advise it, just feels like a really impactful way that I can advocate for people and help make connections, which is one of my favorite things to do. And I love that we have a steering group, because I think it's really important that we have as many aspects of the community represented as we can, so that the decisions made about who to invite come from a really inclusive place. I mean, I'm always there waving my bi flag, but you know, it's just really important to have different perspectives on which books, which authors we want to include, and how we're going to kind of set up those panels of different people together.
Absolutely. So I had planned to talk to you about the publishing and agent panels that you are part of at the Coast is Queer, but I have just checked behind the scenes and they've sold out. So we're not going to spend too much time. Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant, but I don't want to spend too much time talking about things people might not be able to go to. But one thing that you are doing, which we're really excited about, is a workshop with the fantastic journalist and writer Paula Akpan, whose new book, When We Ruled, is out now. And you and Paula are going to be doing an event about developing your nonfiction proposal. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm really excited about this. And I put forward the idea to do something for nonfiction because I've done so many panels and they invariably talk more about fiction writing than nonfiction. I feel like there's a wealth of information out there, which of course is needed and really important. But I feel that the thing that people often don't know how to approach is creating a nonfiction proposal. And in case people don't know, as agents, we sell fiction on a full manuscript, but with nonfiction, we very often sell it on a proposal. And often you need a proposal to get an agent. So I really wanted to create something something that could equip people with that knowledge. It's quite hard to find out what should be in this proposal. How do you put it together? You know, what are the things you need to think about? And then I was thinking about kind of my queer authors, and just thinking about how wonderful Paula's proposal was when she wrote it all that time ago, and just how great she is as well, just sort of talking to people. So I thought that would be a really fun way to just create a really safe, warm, friendly space where people can ask questions. There are no stupid questions. People can come and just find out what they need to know. We'll hopefully make it quite interactive. I think it's going to be really good fun.
Brilliant. So we do still have a few tickets left for that. So if you are interested in developing your nonfiction proposal idea, definitely check out that event. Abby, you at the Coasters Queer Festival, I've seen you there before. I have never seen someone that manages to make it to seemingly every single event, even when they're at the same time.
I know, I need to claim myself this year. There's just too many good events.
What are you most excited about this year seeing?
Oh, I'm so excited about almost everything. I'm really excited about the trans events, because I feel, you know, this year more than ever, just having a space for trans voices is so important, just to, just to be there, be supporting trans writers and hearing their point of view and helping people to better empathize with what the trans community are going through. Some of the big names that we've got are really exciting. Ali Smith, Jackie Kay, Jarl Taylor's back, which is really exciting. But yeah, just some of the panel events I think are going to be fantastic. I love those discussions. I think the festival is so good at creating a space to go beyond just the idea that it's a queer book and really get into the nuance of queerness in lots of different intersections.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so this is a horrible question, but I'm going to ask you 3 queer book recommendations, please.
Well, I'm going to cheat because that's too hard. So I'm going to do 3 book recommendations for authors who are at the festival. So my first is going to be The Safe Keep by Yael, is it Van Wouden?
Van der Wouden, yeah.
Thank you. One of my books of the year. I absolutely loved it. A real sort of slow burn, beautiful literary novel that just had me thinking about it for ages afterwards. I'm really excited for her event. I read Roxy's memoir, What a Girl Wants, recently. That is really fantastic. And then Roxy's at the festival. It's a memoir, but she gets into so many fabulous stories from her life. So many things that people will relate to in lots of different ways, not just about queerness, but also sort of body image and family relationships. It's really funny, but really touching. And then I'm going to shamelessly plug my client, Gina Roche, who is also there, who has a memoir called Rome. It was originally called A Working Class Family Ages Badly. We called it Rome in paperback. It actually came out before I agented Juno, but it's one of my favourite memoirs. Just loved it, really. They have lived such a fascinating life. So, yeah, 2 memoirs and a novel.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Abby. How can people find and follow you and see what you're looking for in terms of manuscripts?
So on the agency website, which is DHH Literary Agency, there's all the information about how to submit to me, what I ask people to send, and also a little bit of a wish list. It's sort of deliberately quite top line because the intricacies of my taste change all the time, but hopefully it's helpful in terms of what genres I don't do and where my focus is a bit more. I'm on Instagram. It's just Abby, which is ABIR Fellows. And that's probably quite a good place. I tend to sort of do a little story of what I'm reading each time I read a new book. So that's a good place to get a sense of who I represent and also what I read in my spare time as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Abby.
My pleasure.
Kit Hayam is a freelance writer, historian, heritage practitioner and educator based in Leeds. They are the author of Before We Were Trans, A New History of Gender, which was published by Basic Books in the UK and Seal Press in 2022. It's a global history of gender nonconformity and was nominated for the 2023 Lambda Literary Award in Transgender Nonfiction and a History Today Book of the Year. They work with museums and in the media to change the way that we tell stories of the queer and trans past. They also sing in 3 choirs, play the tenor horn, co-organise Leeds Queer Film Festival and attempt to meet their toddler's insatiable demands for poetry and fruit. Kit, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
That bio and that CV, I'm surprised you've got time to do anything. So congratulations on finishing this absolutely wonderful book.
Thank you so much. It's a juggling act, as any parent who also tries to have a job knows. But yeah, we make it work. We make it work.
So let's start with your work as a historian. What does a typical week as a queer historian look like for you?
I mean, I always try and carve out a day in every week where I'm writing. I'm working on a new book at the moment, which is due in at the end of November. So I'm writing a lot at the moment. But there's lots of other things that I do as well, partly because writing books about queer history is never going to pay all the bills, and partly because it's a real joy to engage with other people who are fans of queer history. So a typical week might look like a day of writing, running a session of queer history club at my local queer bookshop, which is where we bring in a queer historian to tell people something they didn't know and then run a fun activity based off that. The last one we had, we learned about the queer symbolism of chickens in Chinese culture over the centuries. And then we did a photo taking activity based on that, which is absolutely fab. Then I might lead a walking tour of Leeds' hidden queer history. And I do deliver trans awareness training as well. So that's another big part of kind of what I do. And I do see it as very much related to the writing job because it's all about explaining things that are knotty and complicated in ways that feel accessible and maybe even hopefully fun to people.
Absolutely. So I found Before We Were Trans to be really accessible and really informative and brilliantly written. Do you remember the moment that you were like, yes, I'm going to write this book. We need it?
Thank you for saying that. It wasn't so much a moment as a process, but I can tell you when I think the seeds of it were really sown, which was a conversation that I had when I very, very recently came out as non-binary, in I think it was 2015. And it's very hard to remember that in 2015, like there were not that many high-profile people out as non-binary. I was sort of slightly ahead of the curve of people knowing what it was. So I was doing a lot of having conversations, with people who didn't really believe it was a thing and didn't believe that it was the same as being really trans. I was doing a lot of navigating the idea of what it meant to be really trans and how I butted up against it in society. And I had a conversation with a brilliant historian and archaeologist from the Isle of Man, Claire Corkill, about a story that makes its way into the book of Nokelo internment camp, a First World War internment camp on the Isle of Man, where people assigned male at birth were imprisoned, and a significant proportion of those lived as women full time in the internment camp. And Claire told me this story, and then she said, "Oh, but you know, we don't know how any of them lived afterwards, whether any of them continued living as women, so it's really hard to know whether they were really trans." And that really stuck with me because what that meant was that nobody had been telling that story because they weren't sure what label to put on it. And I thought, this is an incredible story, which not only is really fascinating in its own right, but also tells us a lot about the history of gender. It tells us that people during the First World War had the capacity to treat these internees as genders different from the ones they were assigned at birth, full time, without question. And I thought, we need to be telling this story. We can't just not tell this story because we're not sure whether they count as really trans or not. And that, I think, was a light bulb moment for me in terms of thinking, I really need to write something about this.
Absolutely. I'm going to ask you to read from the beginning of it now, please.
Okay, this is the opening to Before We Were Trans. On the night of Monday, the 8th of June, 1847, John Sullivan was drunk. Strolling unsteadily down the street in Aldgate, East London, the 22-year-old was wearing a bonnet, a gown, a silk apron, a pair of trousers, and a pair of women's boots. Police Constable Henry Pye's attention was caught both by this attire and by the bundle John was carrying under one arm. Steering John to the local police station, he opened the bundle to find more items of women's clothing. "Where," he asked John, "had these come from?" John said, "They're mine." 6 days later, on the 14th of June, John Sullivan was tried for the theft of a cape, a handkerchief, an apron, two gowns, two petticoats, and a pair of stays. The clothes belonged to local woman Frances Norton and had a total value of 13 shillings and sixpence. Under oath, John denied stealing the clothes and dismissed the choice to wear them as a drunken joke, swearing, "I had them given to me to carry to the market. The policeman caught me and the person who gave me the things ran away. I had a gown on in a lark, but I had my trousers on. I was very much intoxicated." The court, mindful that this was John's second offence, following a 6 month prison sentence the previous year for a crime whose records don't appear to survive, was unsympathetic. John Sullivan was sentenced to be transported to Australia for 10 years. Is this story part of trans history? It's unlikely that many people would treat it as such. John Sullivan lived before the word transgender, as we use it now, was widely available for individuals to describe their actions or identities. There's no evidence that John presented as female outside of the specific circumstances outlined in the trial records. Perhaps most conclusively, those trial records give us John's own testimony, framing the choice to wear women's clothes not as a matter of identity, but as a drunken lark. Surely there's no better metric by which to judge a historical person's gender than their own voice. These are the criteria that usually determine whether trans people feel able to talk about someone as belonging to trans history. We look for evidence that their motivation for gender nonconformity was not external but internal, ideally in the form of personal testimony. We look for continuous presentation as the gender opposite to the one they were assigned at birth. And we look for histories that we can fit into contemporary Western ideas of what it means to be trans. Even if these criteria are met, we get anxious if the person we're dealing with lived before the advent of the terminology that we use to talk about trans identities today. Often, this in itself is enough to dismiss their trans possibility altogether. These criteria often make it difficult for us to talk about trans history at all. What makes this conversation even more difficult to have are the concepts that underpin it: gender and sex, internal and external motivations, personal testimony, stability of identity. If we poke at any one of those concepts, the whole edifice starts to crumble. When we talk about trans history, what are we even talking about? This book is about the answer to that question.
Thank you so much, Kit. I'd love to know what the main takeaways are that you hope that people get from this book.
I hope that people, first of all, take away that we can talk about trans history as different from trans people in the past. I don't think it's right to talk about a person as a trans person unless they have used that word themselves. I think, ethically speaking, the principle of talking about people on their own terms is a really important one, both to trans people today. You know, that's why we ask people to refer to us in particular ways, and equally, I think, to people in the past. But I think talking about trans history is different from talking about trans people in the past. And trans history is exactly what I said before, the history of being able to think about gender as distinct from bodies, being able to think about gender as something you can play with, something that can be fluid and flexible and malleable. And I think that really, really opens up the idea of what trans history could be, and importantly, opens up the knowledge that there have always been different and playful and disruptive ways of thinking about gender. And I hope also, I suppose, that people take away the fact that trans history overlaps all the time with other kinds of history, that many of the histories in the book are also gay history and women's history and men's history and intersex history, and that that is not something we have to fight over, but something that instead we might think about in terms of sharing community between different kinds of history, or sharing solidarity between different kinds of history. I'm really keen to get away from the idea that by claiming someone for trans history, we are taking them away from somebody else. I think that's a really obstructive idea to solidarity between queer people today.
Definitely. What's the reaction been to the book, Kit? You know, obviously it's been lauded and it's been nominated for and won prizes, which is so brilliant. But what's the reaction been from readers?
It's been amazing to have emails from people who feel really seen by the book. One of the things I really wanted to do with Before We Were Trans, in talking about people who, in the past, who don't fit into kind of modern trans cis categories, is also to make space for the fact that most trans people's identities are complicated, and you know, our genders intersect and interact with our sexuality and with the roles that we play in society. And that's an experience that lots and lots of people in the past had too, and that actually shaped how gender was understood in the past. And so one of the nice things has been seeing people, you know, on their Instagram stories highlighting bits and going, this is me. And that's been lovely. And I think also the reaction from the US has really surprised me. I never expected anything I'd written to be read by anyone who didn't live in the UK, really. But actually, people in the US have taken it to their hearts, and I think to an extent protest bought it in the response to recent events and transphobia over there. And so that's been really striking as well.
Definitely. So, before we started recording, one of the questions I really like to ask people that I speak to is, what do you not get asked enough? What do you want to dig into while we've got this opportunity? And you mentioned that you'd like to talk about the chapter on intersex identity. So I'd love to get into that with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the factors actually that shaped the book I'm writing now a little bit was the fact that I've had a lot of conversations about this book. People have really wanted to talk about it, which has been amazing. But one of the chapters they haven't really wanted to talk about is the chapter about the intersection between trans history and intersex history. And my feeling is that that is partly for two, that is kind of for two reasons. I think one, it's because a lot of that chapter is about the way that trans people have sometimes appropriated intersex history. Sometimes we've looked at people with intersex bodies or intersex traits in the past and said, this is trans history, these are trans people, and not left space for the fact that they are also intersex history. And that actually a lot of the medical care that trans people benefit from now was built on the back of abuse of intersex people. And so I think there's a discomfort around that chapter. But I think the other place the discomfort comes from is that some of that chapter is about the way that our contemporary ideas of biological sex were socially and historically constructed. And I think people find that hard to get their heads around. But I think it's essential, particularly in an age when the idea of quote unquote biological reality is being used to shut trans people out of various areas of public life. I think it's really, really important that we do talk about the fact that what we think of as biological sex now is not objective. It has a historical, it has a history, and it was historically constructed in a particular time in a particular place. And so actually the work I'm writing now is a little bit more about that. But that was why when you said, what would you like to talk about? I thought no one ever asked about this, and I want to talk about not only what's in that chapter, but also about the reasons why no one talks about it.
So, Kit, we are delighted to have you at the Coast is Queer this year. You will be appearing on a panel called Is a Shared History Possible on the 12th of October alongside fellow queer historians Jane Trace, Paula Akpan, and the event will be chaired by Nat Arias from Sussex University. What can we expect from this event?
I'm so excited. I mean, the first thing you can expect, I think, is me and Paula and Jane being really excited to be in each other's company. I met Jane years and years ago when I was working on the York LGBT History Month charity. And I met Paula, first of all, when she very, very kindly read the manuscript of Before We Were Trans before it was published and suggested some really important changes. And then secondly, when she came to my queer history club that I run in Leeds to promote her incredible book, When We Ruled, about the history of African rulers. And so I think the first thing you can expect is us all being delighted to be in the same space. And you can expect some really nuanced, I think, and I hope interesting and fun discussion about what it means to have a shared history when we're all working with people who understood their genders and their sexualities in different ways, many of which aren't particularly legible to modern Western eyes. And I think that idea of shared history is going to resound really well with all of the different kinds of work that the three of us do.
Definitely. I'm so looking forward to this event. And you can get tickets as ever from the Coast is Queer website. Kit, looking at the lineup for the Coast is Queer, are there any other events that you are desperate to go to?
Oh my God. I really hope that I can make it to the Letters to My Younger Trans Self event, particularly with Juno Rush. Travis Alabanza is there too, who is incredible, but I've never had the chance to see Juno speak. And I absolutely love her book, A Working Class Family Ages Badly. I think she writes so lyrically and so beautifully, and with such aching melancholia about her younger self, that I think that's going to be a really unmissable event, actually.
Definitely. Kit, how can we find and follow you and find out more about your work and more about your new book when you're ready to tell us?
Thank you. So yeah, I'm Kit Haham, writer on Instagram. I'm KR Haham on Blue Sky, and I've got a website. You can find me on Google as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. DG Cortino landed the Bloody Scotland Havel Secker Crime Writing Award in 2021. They also perform spoken word as DGC. They are the co-founder and MC of Boisterous Ravens, a spoken word event featuring Black, Brown and global majority women and non-binary performers. They write short stories, dabbled in script writing, and The Light and Shade of Ellen Swithin is their first novel out now. DG, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello.
I loved The Light and Shade of Ellen Swithin, and I'm so happy that we get to talk about it. Can you give us a little lowdown on what the book is about?
Well, it's funny because people ask me this all the time, and each time I always say, it's not a whodunit. It's you know, we know who done it. She done it. She definitely did it. It's more of a why done it, and will she keep getting away with it? And it's about corporate shenanigans, really, and how somebody who was a mousy exec who kind of, you know, is okay with blending in suddenly decides that actually maybe nice people don't necessarily finish on top and maybe start killing people.
Absolutely. It really brings a new kind of like vibe to having sharp elbows and the corporate ladder.
Yeah, definitely.
When did the idea come to you?
Well, I don't want to drop anybody in it, but a long time ago, I worked in an office and a friend of mine, we were all sort of finished for the day. It wasn't actually a corporate role. It was a role that we had to do with the courts. And we knew we had done everything on time, so we were ready to go. And just as we were ready to leave for the day, a boss came in and said, no, we need to do this, that and the other. And we've all been there, haven't we? And it was like, we were supposed to finish work at 4:30. We didn't get out there till 7. And we went to the bar and we had some drinks. And we were like, wouldn't it be great if you just get away with killing somebody? Like, you just do the one, not even like in a purge way, just kill one person and it would be this boss. And then I went home and wrote about 15,000 words and it just... It just came out of there, and then the character changed a little bit, and then it became The Light and Shade of Ellen Swithin.
Can we hear a short extract, please?
Of course. And like I said before, we know that she kills a character called Noah, and this, I decided, let's get towards a bank holiday, why not have a bit of murder, so I'm going to go straight into it. Ellen grabbed at the laptop case with her free hand and spun it round on her knees. Noah flung himself, shielding the side of his face. Ellen flew at him, propelled by the rage of circumstance and situation, yelling and crying with each swing. Do you know the bleep day I've had, you bleep? Again and again, catching on the hand that was now covering the cut. You bleep piece of bleep, she shouted as she hit him on the side of the head and throat. He fell to the ground, his hair in bloody fringes on his face, and stood blinking down at Noah and the failed piece of office equipment wedged just below his neck. Bleep, oh bleep, oh bleep, Noah, oh bleep, sorry, oh God, oh bleep, bleep, Jesus, bleep. She knelt down again. Oh no, 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 no. She put her hands in her hair and pulled. Noah's eyes were half open, one of his arms twisted behind his head. Ellen jumped up. She did not know how long she had been distracted from the realization that she was in the company car park with a dead executive and top of the line CCTV. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your beautiful bleeping of the profanities.
It's a pretty sweary book, to be fair.
I loved Ellen as a character. What did you do to kind of get inside her head and develop her?
To be fair, I think Ellen and all the characters get inside my head. There were times, I mean, I have a now 13-year-old daughter, and there were times when I had to just like say, look, I'm just, and she'd be like, who are you talking to? And I'd be like, Ellen. She goes, that's not a real character. And I'd be having conversations with them. And it was more that they kind of led me, after a while, those characters kind of
wrote themselves. They kind of, I just followed what they were doing. And there were times when they were completely unreliable, even though I was the one that had written them. So, yeah.
How brilliant. It shows that you absolutely needed to write it. I'd love to know, what drew you to writing crime specifically and queer crime?
Any character that I write will always be queer and will always be black or brown, because those are my core identities. And I think that if you look at the shelves in bookshops, there isn't that vast choice for us. And in terms of crime, I wasn't actually drawn to crime. This was like the first, when I won the award, I was the most surprised, because actually I'd written other stuff before and I really thought that those things would be taken off first. So I wasn't actually drawn to crime. This was literally a bit of a revenge plot because I hated my boss at the time. So the crime bit came later, if you like. I'd kind of written other kind of queer, quirky romances. I'd written just sort of nerdy short stories. I'd written a little bit of literary fiction, but it was this one that was just that got the award. So that's where we are. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, as I say, I loved it. And I'm so excited about the panel you are going to be on at The Coast is Queer, called Not That Innocent, which we've actually spoken about on the show. And we're very, very excited about. What can we expect from this panel?
Well, I'm hoping insights and excerpts and giggling and how, you know, just being drawn to that part of protagonist that is, you know, about being dark and about dark humour, I'm hoping. And I'm hoping that we can kind of get to talk about, well, I'm hoping that I will meet other writers that are into kind of just subverting various tropes in crime and thriller, because I think what has happened is that you get these, you know, each part of a genre has its own tropes, but it's great to kind of read something that twists it a little bit. And I think it'd be lovely to just listen to other writers who've done the same kind of thing as I've done with Ellen.
Definitely. Didi, what other events at The Coast is Queer are you hoping to get to?
As many as I possibly can. It's I like music festivals and I love book festivals. And it's that thing where you know when events clash, you think, what am I going to go to? The minute I stop with my panel, I'll be belting out to seeing whatever I possibly can. I will be in every room.
We are so excited to have you there. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your brilliant book?
Well, thank you very much. It is available everywhere, in any kind of bookstore, all the famous ones. But to be fair, I'm supporting independent shops. And if we're talking about Brighton, Afori Books, and if we're talking about, I'm going to have a shout out to Heath Bookshop in Birmingham, because they've been so supportive, and they're my favourite bookshop in the world. Any bookshop and online. My socials are That Blackhearted Captain on Instagram. So drop me a DM, and if you haven't found it, I will tell you where to get it.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can't wait to see you.
Pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. Love to talk to you.
To round off the show today, the lovely Sarah from Writers HQ is joining us to talk about their Writing as Resistance Festival, a deep dive into the radical nature of creativity and the transformative possibilities of stories. It runs from Monday the 1st of September to Tuesday the 30th of September and is all held online. Sarah, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks, Anna, and thanks for having me. It's amazing to be here.
Firstly, can you tell us a little bit about Writers HQ?
Yes, absolutely. Writers HQ is a community for writers who want to stop messing about and get their writing done. We run one-day procrastination-busting writing retreats across the UK, but they started in Brighton in 2012, so a long time ago now. We also run online courses and online workshops. Throughout the year, we also run month-long festivals that focus on novel writing and productivity and short fiction and the Writing as Resistance Festival. And everything we do is geared around getting people to stop thinking about writing and actually get their words on the page. Brilliant. So let's talk about the Writing as Resistance Festival. When did the idea come to you and why did you set it up?
So there is a long-running joke in the community that Writers HQ is actually a secret cult hell-bent on dismantling the capitalist patriarchal hegemony. And a lot of that comes from the weekly newsletters, which are ostensibly full of pep and enthusiasm and designed to get people writing. But the way we do that is by highlighting the way that stories aren't just frivolous things that we do for fun, but really the bedrock of what makes humanity humanity. And these are all things we do naturally, like writing and singing and dancing and art. And all these things have been captured by consumerism and capitalism to be things that we're supposed to be, quote, good at, as opposed to things we just do because that's what people do. So this is kind of an ongoing thread. And I have a personal interest in stories about climate change. I used to be a journalist writing about climate change, and sort of latterly I've become very obsessed, I could say, with fictional stories about climate change, but also stories as a tool for social change and resistance. Before the pandemic, we ran a weekend-long residential writing retreat called The Retreat of the End of the World, which was really magical. And we spent 3 days exploring what climate change stories could be and should be and all these kind of things. And it was a really intensely powerful moment that was meant to continue in some way. Then obviously 2020 happened and everything sort of fell apart for a while. And then last year, so 2024, Sarah Royston, who is a longtime Writers HQer, she works at Anglia Ruskin University. She got some funding for a writer's weekend. She invited me and two other writers, and the four of us spent this incredible few days discussing and working on embodied writing and resistance writing. And the first festival grew out of that as a way to explore writing that is radical and political and powerful. And it was an incredible month. And it really felt like a return to the path we had been on with that first climate retreat, and also something Writers HQ has been building up to for a while. And now we're here. So that was probably quite a long answer.
But a brilliant one. So the lineup is fantastic. I mean, looking at it now, you've got some of my favourite writers actually on it. I would love to go through every single event with you with a fine-tooth comb, but I'm just going to ask you to pick out a few highlights that you would like to get on people's radars.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I also need to say that I really overbooked and I completely blew my budget because there are so many amazing workshops, and there are so many workshops that aren't on here that I really, really want on here. So hopefully they'll be there next year. So we are opening, I'm going to talk about one of my workshops, which is, you know, seems a bit self-involved considering there's so many great writers, but we're sort of opening the festival with a workshop called Writing Through the Apocalypse. This is free. It's a sort of a hybrid of a workshop I ran last year called Radical Stories for Radical Change and a workshop I ran earlier in the year, which was around how we can keep going when everything seems so terrible and scary and sometimes hopeless. And this is a workshop just exploring what writers are for, why stories are important, how we can get deeper into our own writing practice and really connect with that when it feels often pointless. I'm really looking forward to it. I love running these kind of workshops. I love the community and the way that everybody is there. Everybody comes with so much positivity and hope. And I think that's an incredibly powerful thing. The next workshop I want to highlight is called Making the Political Personal with Leonie Ross. Leonie is one of my favourite authors and one of my favourite people. I think she is incredible. And she's so, I don't know how she manages to be so chill all the time. She just sounds so, like every workshop I do with her, I'm just like, oh, I feel like I'm sort of soothed into writing something amazing. And her books are, she does this incredible thing where all the politics in the stories are expressed so cleverly through her characters. So she's running a whole workshop on
avoiding sounding didactic, and how, you know, having strong opinions about things is actually great. And she's sort of inviting people to find their loud and revolutionary voices. So that is going to be awesome. Then there's also a workshop called Writing from Desire and Body by Lynn S. Nguyen. And she is another incredible author who she really focuses on the sort of process of writing and this idea of embodied writing, of kind of writing from the sensations in your body rather than just the thoughts in your mind, and sort of paying attention to sort of what's bubbling underneath. So that workshop is also going to be incredible. Okay, so Stereotypical Tropes in Working Class Writing with Kathy Hoyle. Kathy is a longtime Writers HQ facilitator. She is just brilliant. She actually, I think she joined Writers HQ years and years ago as a student and then sort of became one of our workshop facilitators and ran retreats for a while. And just watching her journey from being quite uncertain and quite unsure what she was doing to this absolute powerhouse of a writer. She's doing a PhD now in creative writing, and her, she's just incredible. Her stories are so powerful, and she just believes very deeply in exploring and subverting the kind of working class stereotype.
It really, really sounds like you've got such a rich, rich, wonderful lineup here. So through the months, Writers HQ also have write-alongs. What is a write-along and why should writers join them?
A write-along is just an hour on Zoom where we all write together. It's very, very simple, but very, very effective. It's often quite hard to carve out time to sit and write. It can be difficult to prioritise it. And this is just a dedicated chunk of time where you're together with other writers and we write in, I think it's 2 25-minute sprints with little breaks and little sort of pep breaks in the middle. And a lot of our writers are neurodivergent. A lot of them are just very busy. And it's just this sort of time that you carve out to be with other people all doing the same thing. It's very productive and just really helps you feel like you're part of a community. And you also bash out a whole load of words.
Brilliant, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us. So how can people get tickets to the festival and get involved?
So all the events are completely free if you are a Writers HQ member. The membership is all on our website, writershq.co.uk/membership. It's either £20 a month or a cancel any time, or £190 for the year, and that also gives you access to the entire library of previous workshops, so you will get access to all of last year's workshops as well if you want to sort of catch up on those. And there are also three events that are completely free. You just need an account. There's the first one, Writing Through the Apocalypse. There's one halfway through the month called Inspiring New Writing with European Art and Culture with Beth Daly. And then the final one, the Writers HQ Literary Submission Orgy, where we will all be submitting loads of our new stories to various lit mags at the end of the month.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's show as much as I enjoyed recording it. As ever, you can find out information about everyone that we've spoken to on the show in the podcast show notes. Just download it from wherever you get your podcasts from. We also have a lot of information over on our Instagram page at BTM Book Club. You can get your tickets for The Coast is Queer at The Coast is Queer website. And also, if you are a writer in Brighton, or even someone who wants to embark on a creative project or has a deadline that they really need to meet, I am running a one-day writing retreat in the heart of Brighton at the West Hill Hall on October the 4th. There are tickets available, and if you are on low or no income, we have some free places available. It's a great opportunity to get your head down, focus on your work, connect with other local writers, and also hear the advice from an industry expert at the end of the day. You get tea, coffee, biscuits on tap. We can have a chat about any of your work that you're getting stuck with, and I'd really love to see you there. You can find information at the link in our bio on Instagram at BTM Book Club, and they are available via Eventbrite. We will be back next month. I'll see you at The Coast is Queer.